The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So this week in the daily life practice retreat that we're having, many of you here are attending, some are just here for the evening. We're looking at, one of the things we're looking at is how to work with challenging, or maybe we could say more repetitive, habits and patterns that tend to catch us up in our daily lives. And it's come up a couple of times, because much of what we're exploring is how to be mindful of them. You know, how can we become aware of these habits and patterns? And the question has come up several times around, is that all we do? What do we do when we notice them? How does this, and underlying that, I think, is the question of how does this work? You know, and kind of the sense of why would just paying attention to something do anything? And I certainly had that perspective when I first met mindfulness practice. And I told this story on Sunday at the opening day of the retreat, but I'll just repeat it briefly here. And what really got me into this practice was anger that was kind of uncontrollable. And I got this book from a friend that gave me the idea to start just being aware of it when it happened. And when I read that, you know, my friend sent me this book and said, well, this has been really helpful for me. You might try this. And when I read it, I thought, well, what good is that going to do? You know, paying attention to my anger, isn't that just going to make me more angry? But at that point, and maybe it was fortunate in a way, because I had kind of hit bottom. I had tried many things in my life to be happy, to change my conditions, to figure out how to live my life so that I would have some ease and happiness in my life. And it just seemed like everything I had tried, and I felt like I'd hit bottom. There was nothing more I could try. And so, you know, this friend sent me this book. It's like, well, pay attention. It's like, well, I don't know what good that's going to do, but I haven't got anything else to try, so I might as well try that. And so I did just start exploring that, just trying to be attentive, to be aware when I was angry. And I did this entirely in daily life, entirely. I didn't even start meditating. I was not interested in meditating. A friend who'd sent me a book, the book, told me she had recently sat a day long, and I thought she had joined a cult. You know, I thought she'd kind of gone off the deep end with this meditation stuff, but coming from somebody now who sits 3-month retreats. So I just began exploring it in my daily life. So initially it was very much just, can I recognize when I'm angry? And that was pretty much all I did for a couple of months. And it was that simple. I'm angry. I know I'm angry. Yep, wow, that's unpleasant. Okay, well, I've got these other things to do, so I'll get on with my day. It was really that basic, what I did. But what happened is that the mind began to kind of be attuned to that experience of anger and kind of woke up with it more easily, more quickly. And what it seemed to do was to kind of lead me back to the beginnings of the anger. It led me towards seeing kind of earlier in the process of the cycle of anger. And at one point I saw a thought arise in the mind about the person that I was angry with. And I wasn't angry when the thought arose, but I could see this momentum towards anger. And this just happened. You know, this was not something I was trying to do. I wasn't particularly trying to be mindful at that time. I was just in my kitchen doing some stuff. And this thought arose, and the awareness of, you want to get angry. And my understanding about why that happened is because the mind was so attuned to anger. The mindfulness was so attuned to anger that it was waking up at the least whiff of anger. And in seeing that, in that moment, the mind, having experienced in the previous couple of months how painful anger was, and having seen all the views and ideas and beliefs about, along the way, I learned that I thought that there was value to being angry because I thought it was going to make the other person miserable. And I realized that this was a complete myth in my mind because the other person didn't even know I was angry. So that whole kind of belief underlying the anger was useless. And so I had been spending the time seeing the pain of being angry. Sometimes in the Buddhist teachings, anger is talked about as being like a hot coal. You pick up the hot coal to throw at somebody to make them burn, but you burn yourself first. And that's what I was experiencing, was that I was burning with this anger. And so over the couple of months of just recognizing, yep, wow, that's anger, wow, that hurts, and getting on with my day, the mind had gained some wisdom. I'm going to use some of this, the Buddhist language, the understanding, the wisdom about how the mind works and what suffering is. That this experience of anger was painful internally. And so that experience of knowing directly, wisdom knew, the wisdom had developed that understood anger equals painful experience in the moment. And when the mind saw at this moment in the kitchen, when the mind saw the heading towards anger, before I was angry, that whiff of, like the scent of anger coming was what mindfulness picked up on. It saw the scent of anger coming. The wisdom said, yeah, just don't go there. And the mind let go of it, kind of like we would let go of something hot, touching a hot pot on the stove. The body just naturally withdraws from it. That's what happened. I didn't have to do that. And so that moment actually was a very powerful moment for me because there was the recognition and the language that I'm going to use, I'm going to bring in a sutta here in a moment, called the simile of the cloth, in which we're encouraged to understand our difficulties so that they can be abandoned. And so this, the process of spending a couple of months looking at this process of anger in my mind was developing some understanding about the anger, understanding about the views and beliefs that came with that anger, understanding something about the experience, the painfulness of the anger here, understanding also that anger wanted to cause harm to someone else. That was humbling. I could see the thought in my mind arise, like, I just want them to be so miserable, and I want them to hurt that person that I was angry with, and feeling in that moment that this is the seeds of war. And so it's so much learned in that, just through those little moments, just seeing those little moments of anger and being aware of them, for, I don't know, it's probably no more than 2 to 5 seconds each time that I woke up and noticed that pattern in my daily life. 2 to 5 seconds, 6, 7 times a day for a couple months. And this process unfolded. It wasn't something I tried to make happen. The thing that I did was tried to connect with the experience, tried to explore, can I know that I'm angry while I'm angry? And that's, I mentioned that in the guided meditation, the difference between being angry and being aware of anger. There's a vast difference between those two, and it's really important to recognize the difference between those two. We can we can know that we're, I mean, one of the things one of my teachers, Saito Tajaniya, says, you know, if you see somebody that's angry on the street and you walk up to them and say, do you know that you're angry? They're going to kind of look at you like you're nuts. They're going to say, yeah, of course I know I'm angry. But that's not the kind of mindfulness. It's not the kind of awareness that is curious about, and how does it feel to be angry? It's the kind of awareness of anger that is, how can I get back at the person I'm angry with? And so this is a vast difference between these two. And so this very simple, that's one of the things we need to begin to be curious about is, are we attending with this curiosity of what is this experience? What is this to be a human being that's feeling this thing, this habit, this pattern, this reactivity, depression, self-hatred, anger, frustration, anxiety? So many different patterns have been spoken about in this week when we're together. Just what is this? And in some ways, you know, in daily life, we don't have as much bandwidth, I'd say, for a detailed exploration often. You know, we get basically just a little hit of recognition and maybe something that's obvious. Just a little hit of recognition and, oh, this is what's obvious right now. You know, maybe this moment is something about the beliefs involved in the anger, and this moment is something about the pain in the body around it. But just little accumulations of understanding happen. So I'm going to pause that story for now and kind of explore this sutta. So the simile of the cloth is a story where the Buddha is talking to some followers and asks them to consider a cloth that has stains in it. A cloth that you want to dye, that you want to put into a vat of color and give it a new color. But the cloth has stains in it. And he says, will that cloth take up the dye evenly? Will it be a beautiful cloth if you dye it with those stains? And the answer is no, because the stains take up the dye differently than the cloth. And he said, but if you scrub that cloth, if you clean it, if you remove the stains, then when you put the cloth into the dye, it takes up the dye evenly, and it's beautifully dyed. The color is even. The word that means stain is kilesa in the Pali, and it is often translated, it's often used in the context of reactivity in our minds. It's often translated with the word defilement. We don't have to go into the word so much. It's not a word that we use very much in English, and it often has a flavor to it that has an aversive quality to it. Just the word itself almost seems to embody aversion. And we're not trying to be averse to our reactive emotions. We're trying to open to them with compassion. And so the word may be a little problematic, defilement. So, but it's interesting, I think, that in this case, he's using the word that means stain. You know, he's using this word that means stain. And if we think about what a stain is, it's something that is not inherent in the cloth. It's something that comes in because of conditions, and it can be removed because of conditions. So this is the way these reactive patterns in our minds are. They come into our minds because of conditions, and they can be removed with conditions. There's some work that has to happen to remove the stain, you know. You can't just wish it away. You have to get it into some soap and scrub it and take some action to remove those stains. And so this is a kind of the sutta. It uses this analogy to describe the path of practice in a way. That the first part of the path is to look into our minds and to notice, recognize these reactive patterns, see the stains. Actually, first recognize, yep, there's stains in there. There is reactivity in there. And the language is something like knowing these reactivities, these reactive emotions, as stains in the mind, one abandons them. And this teaching goes through a list of 16 different defilements. I don't have the sutta with me. I forgot to bring it, but... basically, it's, you know, all of those messy things, self-hatred, you know, anger, greed, pride, all of that, you know, conceit, confusion, frustration, irritation, all of those are, you know, the stains in the mind. That basically states of mind that are based in greed, aversion, or confusion, delusion would be these kind of reactive states of mind. And so the teaching says that knowing them, abandon, knowing these as stains in the mind, that's the language. Knowing, for instance, anxiety. Anxiety's come up a lot this week. So knowing anxiety as a stain in the mind, one abandons it. The sutta goes on then that once they are abandoned, and this is the abandoning piece, the knowing and the abandoning piece is really what I'm going to emphasize in this talk. Because it goes on, actually, the teaching goes on that once these stains in the mind have been abandoned, then basically the mind begins to pick up the beautiful qualities of the Dharma, like the dye. Is just absorbed naturally. And so once the work of the knowing and the abandoning has happened, the rest of the Dharma, the rest of the path seems to be described as unfolding very naturally. So the next thing it says is, confidence arises in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. When confidence has arisen, inspiration follows. When we're confident in the path, we're confident in the teachings, we're engaged. We want to connect. We want to follow the path. We continue. Inspiration, gladness, rapture, tranquility, concentration naturally follow. These are described as being a result of confidence having arisen. That this is, and there's one teaching that says when there is, for instance, the confidence, there's no need for an act of will, may gladness arise. When gladness arises, there's no need for an act of will, may rapture arise. Rapture will naturally arise following on from gladness. And so it goes on that way for all of these. Happiness arises, concentration naturally follows. Now, it's not that we don't have to do anything. It's just it's a kind of, we have to, like in the analogy, you know, if we want to look at the simile, if we've done the work of scrubbing the cloth and we've got the cloth that's free of stains, we can't just sit there looking at the cloth. We have to put it in the dye. You know, we have to kind of maybe swirl it around a little bit in there. The dye comes in naturally. We don't do anything to make the dye come in other than put it in the condition, put it in the container. And so we could look at this as being, let's put ourselves in the container of the Dharma with that mind that has the interest of releasing, abandoning the stains in the mind. And it will begin to pick up, pull up those qualities. And yet, the work here. So there's more. There's the work in the analogy and in our practice really lies in the cleaning of the cloth. the cleaning of the stain. And with the language, again, it says, knowing anxiety as a stain in the mind, as a defilement of mind, one abandons it. So we would often think, I think, the way our minds work habitually, the way that things work in our ordinary lives, maybe, is that if there's something in the way that needs to be gotten rid of, we the work is in the getting rid of. So we think we have that. We think in this sentence, knowing this is a defilement of mind, abandon it. That the work would be in the abandoning. That we'd have to take some action to abandon these difficult states of mind. But the first part of that sentence is knowing this as a defilement of mind. Let's look at that part. Because that is really, we could look at that as being a kind of a an encouragement to recognize it as something that's happening in the mind. The first noble truth of the Buddha is understand suffering. And that understanding is not an intellectual understanding, but an understanding that comes with mindfulness. And so these kalesa, these stains, these reactive habits, patterns, they are suffering. As soon as we look at them, we recognize that. That was the very first understanding I got when I turned and looked at anger. It's like, oh yeah, this hurts. It's dukkha. This is suffering. And so understanding suffering in that first noble truth really means to be curious about it, to understand it as a human experience with mindfulness. Not to follow it with our usual habitual patterns. So this is really, we could say that the abandoning here, that there is an abandoning happening here. We are abandoning our usual way of being with anger by being mindful of it. Our usual way of being with anger is to follow it, to believe the stories that it's telling, to take action based on it. And so what being mindful of it is doing is changing our relationship to it, abandoning our usual way of being with it. And so the abandoning, in my experience, there may be some times when it does feel like we can consciously set something aside, put it down, let it go. But often I've seen that the most powerful times of abandoning is when it is not me trying to do it, but it is the wisdom that has grown from the understanding. The wisdom that has grown from the curiosity about what is this as a human experience. When that wisdom has grown to a certain point, the wisdom does the abandoning. This takes trust to step into this. This is not our usual way of thinking things work, that we just simply witness something, witness it, and we don't even get to feel sometimes the way the wisdom grows. You know, it's like little tiny grains of wisdom kind of collect and gather, and it's like, you know, a little grain of sand just gets dropped there, and it grows, but we don't feel it growing day to day. But at some point, that wisdom around a particular experience is strong enough that it allows the mind to abandon that pattern. So the trust, you know, it's interesting to me in this sutta, it says that you know, once they are abandoned, it says, knowing that these, knowing fear, anxiety is a defilement of the mind, one abandons them. Having abandoned them, one gains confidence in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. It says one gains complete confidence in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, actually. But in my experience, it takes some measure of confidence to even do this understanding thing. So some of that we have to kind of borrow, in a way. That's been my experience of borrowing it from books, borrowing it from friends. Like my deciding to even try this was, my friend sent me the book. She said, this has helped me. And in spite of the fact that I thought she'd kind of gone off the deep end with the meditation, I trusted her. So it's like, well, it helped her. Maybe it'll help me. So I was borrowing her confidence. I was borrowing also the confidence from the book where it said, this has been helpful. This has helped many people. And so there was a sense of the willingness to step on to something that I didn't know how it would work. That is a form of confidence. That is a form of trust. So sometimes we have to kind of suspend our rational mind about figuring out how something's going to work before we try it, especially with the Dharma, because the Dharma is so counterintuitive. The way it works is so counterintuitive. It does not work anything like our usual way that our minds have been conditioned to believe things work. It follows the laws of conditioning, and yet for some reason our minds have gotten so confused about what it means to be happy. I mean, that's kind of the basic confusion that we have. We think we want to be happy, and that happiness means getting what I want, getting rid of what I don't want, having a kind of a string of pleasant experiences one after another, or being able to control my environment so that I don't have unpleasant experience. So we think that's what happiness means. And the Buddha asked a different question. He said, what about having a sense of ease and happiness and peace no matter what the conditions are, so that I don't have to be this like hamster in a hamster cage continually spinning a new environment? What does it mean to be at ease with whatever is already here? So the practice of understanding, I think that's actually more where the work is in this practice. When we think about that analogy of the scrubbing, you know, it's actually, maybe we could, you know, take it a little further. You know, let's throw some soap in there. You know, the soap could be the mindfulness. So, you know, the work, the agitation to rub the cloth, and the soap, you know, spreads the mindfulness in that stain. So you're like, you're doing the work to have the soap penetrate the stain. That's what you're doing when you're scrubbing the cloth. You don't actually go in there and pull the dirt out. The soap does that job. The way soap works is it chemically binds to the stain, and then when you rinse it, it's more the stain is more attached to the soap than it is to the cloth, and so it comes out, it rinses out. And so what we're doing with the work is kneading our kilesas with mindfulness. We are, you know, massaging them like we're washing our minds with mindfulness. The mindfulness will begin to penetrate those habits and patterns. And here it goes a little beyond the analogy. It begins to reveal the way it works. It begins to point out that we've had mistaken ideas about the value of that habit or pattern. It shows us how much pain it causes us. It points out the suffering. It points out beliefs and ideas about it. And so this mindfulness, again, it's like this slow accumulation of wisdom. And when the wisdom gets to a certain point, maybe we could say that's like the rinse water is rinsing the stain out of the mind. So it does take some confidence to step on the path. And part of the reason for offering this talk is to maybe inspire some confidence in stepping into this washing machine without knowing how it works. It doesn't actually take that long to see how it works. And then you don't have to borrow the confidence anymore. So that experience I told you about, the moment when the mind saw the mind headed towards the anger. I was in the kitchen, and the mind saw this thought about the person I was angry with, saw the mind headed towards anger, and the mind just let it go. So we could say that was kind of the accumulation of wisdom from those months of just those small moments of looking at anger. The wisdom had been strong enough to kind of see the smell of anger coming and go, I don't think so. And it just let it go. It released it. It abandoned it. And so there was that abandoning through the knowing. I didn't try to do the abandoning. It happened. And with that moment of abandoning, the seeing of that was so amazing. You know, it was like I had never seen this person come into my mind and anger not come into my mind. I was actually standing there waiting to get angry because I couldn't fathom that. I mean, I thought, oh, that's just going to be for that split second. But it was gone. It was gone for at least that moment. And what arose in the next moment was, wow, this stuff works. I'm going to do this. I'm committed. This is amazing. I don't know how it worked, but it works, so I'm on board. So that was, I think, kind of the sense of the confidence arising in seeing the abandoning happen. There's a kind of a deeper sense of confidence that can arise when we begin to taste those fruits of the abandoning happen. So I just want to talk in general a little bit about this, the process of understanding, the process of maybe we could call it investigation, looking at our experience. Some of this may be more applicable for sitting meditation than daily life. As I said earlier, you know, there's not a lot of opportunity necessarily for investigation in the midst of a conversation with a coworker or you know, in the rapid ways that things happen. We may just be able to get the little, like, you know, this is, wow, yep, noticing that pattern again. Oh, here it is again. Okay, and yep, just get on with my day. But at the same time, that is a form of investigation. It's just, what are you seeing about this? What's there in that moment? It's like you've got a pastiche, and you're getting a little bit of the color here one time, and a little bit of it here another time, and a little bit of it here another time. And at a certain point, the image pops in because you've got enough of the pieces in the puzzle. Just a little bits here and there. And at first, you can't make any connections, but at some point, there's enough information that the mind puts together the picture. This kind of investigation, that happens in daily lives, this form of just recognizing it and noticing something very simple, it takes time. And so there's some faith or confidence needed in the slowness of this process. We need to have some patience with this process. I sometimes reflect on, how does information happen? There's different ways we can go out and we can kind of dig and look and try to figure things out and pull out our books and read and do things and study and then go back and look at things. Or we could kind of just get in the world and start looking and seeing what's here. That's more what we can do in our daily life practice. It's just like, what's here? What's the nature happening here? It's like being a naturalist of your own mind. A naturalist goes out into nature and just sits there. They don't go out and they don't cut down the trees and take the tree back to the lab and like chop it up and look at the cells. I mean, there's a value to that. You can learn something about the nature of growth and cells and all kinds of things. But you can also learn something different if you just go sit in nature. You learn something very different about the tree. You learn something more about how it's connected to other things. You might learn what kind of animals live in it, what kind of animals use it for food. You might begin to notice over a longer stretch of time how it begins to lean towards the sun or the moisture that comes. So, just sitting there day to day, something new. Oh, there's something new. Oh, the next day, there's something new. Just a little bit of information each time. Imagine the very first humans that looked up at the sky, the stars at night. We can't even think of it being a first human. I mean, anyway, we'll go there. So humans look up at the sky at night, and there's like no books or anything telling you, yep, that's Orion, that's Betelgeuse, it's going to explode into a supernova any day now. I don't know if you've been reading that, but... And then there's, the planets, and they kind of move through the stars. There's stars that are fixed, and there's stars that kind of wander through the sky, and then there's the moon. And so you start to see that they rise at different times. The moon rises a little bit later each day. So you learn something. If you're just going out and looking, you can go look it up in books, or you can just go out and look. Make your own patterns. See what's there. You would begin to notice if you went out and looked every night. I mean, the movement of some of those stars is pretty subtle. It takes repeated observation to go out there, look at the sky, and notice, oh yeah, that red star, it was to the left of that star, and now it's to the right. It was to the left of that star like 2 or 3 weeks ago, and now it's to the right. And then you keep watching it, and then you see it go forward and go back and go forward. So you begin to chart, you can begin to chart the course. So you learn something just through watching. This is the kind of patience and observation that's needed for our learning about our hearts and minds. This kind of... curiosity about, well, what's this? What's this human experience? So with our aiming to know or understand the defilements in our minds, these reactive patterns and habits, one of the things we need to remember, and this comes back to earlier in the day, earlier this evening, I talked about the difference between being angry and being aware that you're angry. We are looking at these patterns and habits to understand them, not to get rid of them. And so the perspective that we need to bring is one of curiosity, of understanding, not of aversion to get rid of. And so that takes some humility. It takes some courage to be willing to understand these patterns and habits. And then also we also have to recognize that the desire to get rid of them, I mean, once we start to see, it's very natural. You start to see the pain of anxiety, the struggle and inherent in frustration or anger. And what happens when something's unpleasant? We want to get rid of it. So that's very natural that that would happen. And yet we have to kind of make the container a little bigger. We can't then say, okay, getting rid of it is bad, so I've got to get rid of the getting rid of. That's, you know, just more aversion on top of the aversion to aversion. So it's kind of more like making the container bigger. Okay, there's this pattern of anxiety. And I want it to go away. And of course we want it to go away because it's hurt, it's painful. I want it to go away. Can I know that there's anxiety and I want it to go away? So that's taking a step back to what we might call the relationship or the attitude connected to that pattern of mind. So there's anxiety and then there's wanting it to go away, feeling like it's a problem. That's actually, maybe it's some progress because, like with anger, for instance, it took a while before I thought it was a problem. You know, it's like, no, this is what's going to make this other person miserable and I'll be happy when they're miserable. It was a while before I could see, oh, this is painful and, oh, I don't like that. I would like it to go away. And yet, we can't then direct that aversion towards ourselves. So we need to kind of make the container of mindfulness bigger to hold, okay, there's the anger and there's wanting it to go away. There's the frustration and there's wanting it to go away. And can we just know that without it being a problem? That's what's happening right now. There's anxiety. And there's a belief that it's a problem. That's what's going on in the mind right now. If we are, and we will, this happens. I spent a lot of time looking at unpleasant sensations in my body with the agenda to make it go away. Because I could, with a certain level of concentration, dive into painful sensation with enough focus that it broke apart and was no longer experienced as painful. So I spent a lot of time doing that. And I learned something. I learned a lot from it, actually. And yet what I was also doing was cultivating aversion. And at some point, I had to meet that. I had to meet that aversion to the pain. These things are going to be hidden. These attitudes may be hidden at times. It's like if you are not seeing, and if you check in and say, it's like, okay, well, what's happening right now? Well, there's this anxiety. What's my relationship to it? Well, I don't really know. It seems like it's okay to look at this. You may not see that there's an agenda there. That's okay. Just be with it. If that pattern starts getting stronger while you're looking at it, it's a pretty good sign there might be an agenda there, something else going on. And then it might be useful to kind of step back, attempt to be mindful of it at that point, because that agenda is kind of informing the mindfulness. And it's kind of like we maybe have our foot on the gas pedal of that particular habit or pattern, so it's amping up. So there are times when if we notice, if we're trying to be mindful of something, if it's getting stronger, that's a time to step back from it, to set it aside, to maybe engage with it a little differently. So the investigation around our habits and patterns, it's really a soft thing. You know, we might feel like, and I've seen this at times, having watched and seen a little bit about a particular pattern or done some reflection about it. Like one time I was looking at depression in my mind. I was experiencing a low-grade depression over many weeks at a retreat. It was a long stretch of time. And I had, you know, experienced depression a lot in my life. I had a lot of ideas about where it came from and what it was connected to. And, you know, I kind of just told myself, well, let me just put those aside. You know, I'm not going to assume those things are there. Let me just see what's happening. When is it arising here? What's happening? You know, so I began to be curious about it, the pattern of that. So there can be a temptation, like, for instance, the idea that I had in my mind. I noticed that I would often have a feeling of depression arise when I saw other people walking and talking together. And my mind said, you know, when I was a kid on the playground, I was always left out, and they were always talking about me behind my back, and this must be connected to that. That's kind of the story my mind made about it. Fortunately, I decided to just set that aside and just observe. Because if we kind of use those hypotheses, let's say, if we use those hypotheses to dive into our investigation, one of the amazing things about our mind is that it will often find what it looks for. It will essentially construct the evidence for what we're looking for. And so it takes a real honesty and kind of a bare attention. What is actually happening here? Being curious about just the stars in the sky, you know, just this. And so I began noticing there were lots of different times and places that the depression arose. And then there were times that it wasn't there. That's a really useful tool. I began to see that highlighting for myself when the depression was not there, especially for something that was kind of pervasive, because this was a very pervasive pattern. It was like, until I noticed that it actually wasn't there, I'd kind of assumed it was always there for those weeks. And then I began actually noticing, oh, it's not there a lot of the time. I've just been kind of assuming it's there. And so that's another useful kind of tool or tip for exploring a pattern, a habitual pattern. Notice when it's not happening. Sometimes when we notice it's not happening, that can call it up. That can be interesting if that happens. But often I find it is actually just like, oh, well, actually, no, it's not there. And what was so interesting about that was the recognition that began to really point out the way in which the depression was arising in dependence on something else. And often it was a thought in the mind. A thought arose, and then the depression would arise. And so it began to be understood as a conditioned pattern. So this is kind of how investigation can work. It's just a very gentle being, like, in the nature of it. What is the nature of this tree growing? What is it like to sit in the wilderness of this mind state and notice what happens around it? Well, there's a lot more I could say on this, actually, but I've covered quite a bit of this, so I want to leave some time for any comments or questions. Yeah, Kumi. And why don't we use the mics?
So where do you find the law of conditioning?
I'm sorry?
Where do you find the law of conditioning you mentioned?
What do you mean, where do you find it?
I mean, in the, is it taught?
It is, yes. It could be. It's taught in a couple of different ways. One, it's taught in terms of, it's taught as a law of nature, basically. And that's called the law of karma. That is taught as when we follow or when we act, when our actions are motivated out of greed, aversion, or delusion, that tends to create in the future at some point, not necessarily immediately, but it tends to create more greed, aversion, and delusion. It tends to create suffering when we act out of greed, aversion, and it tends to create also unpleasant experience. So that's one way of framing it. And then when we act out of non-greed, non-aversion, non-delusion, that leads to more of a happiness. It leads to more of a more pleasantness in our lives, but not the pleasantness of the getting. It's just the pleasantness of the consequences of letting go of the reactivity. So that's a very simple way of describing the law of karma, that basically when we act out of unwholesome states are more conditioned. We end up with more of those in our mind. When we act out of wholesome states, more of those are conditioned. We end up with more wholesome states in our mind. So when we act out of love and compassion, that tends to condition love and compassion arising more frequently in our minds. Another way this is taught in one single sentence is whatever the mind frequently ponders, that becomes the inclination of the mind. So that's a very succinct definition of conditionality. And then there's a couple of others. It's actually kind of embedded in the Four Noble Truths. The first noble truth, there is suffering. Suffering should be understood. The second noble truth, there is suffering arises in dependence on craving. That's the second noble truth. With the arising of craving is the arising of suffering. So that's a conditionality. When craving arises, suffering arises. The third noble truth is it's possible for that craving to end, and the ending of that craving is the ending of suffering. So that's a kind of reverse conditionality. Craving arises, suffering arises. Craving ceases, suffering ceases. And then the fourth noble truth is that the path leading to the end of suffering, so the Eightfold Path, are conditions that support the mind to be able to understand suffering so that it can see how suffering arises with craving and releases when craving releases. So that it's expressed in many, many ways. The law of conditionality is a really big part of the Buddhist teachings.
It certainly is.
Yeah, I mean, there's another teaching, the law of dependent origination, which describes both how the sense of self arises and how suffering arises, and that's a chain of conditions. It's a chain of conditionality. So it's everywhere. It's everywhere. Oh, and it's time to stop. Sorry about that. So I can take questions afterwards, but thank you all.